The founder of religious science, Ernest Holmes, had a dream. And his dream was to create a spiritual philosophy based on the principles of universal truth that arise in all cultures in the form of science, philosophy, and religion. And that dream was religious science. And what I know is that the basic teachings of religious science, or the science of mind, are based on the principles that are taught by the Christ in the Western tradition. But I also know that what we teach does not preclude, nor does it exclude, and it specifically includes the principles of universal truth that are taught in all of the great religions. We do not practice those religions, but we practice the principles, the underlying truths that we find in those religions. And I think it's important for us to understand how those truths translate into what we do in religious science, so that today I'm going to consider the cornerstone of the Buddhist philosophy, which is referred to as the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. And I think this is important because what I have been noticing more and more is that the highest teachings of Buddhism are definitely finding their way into our culture today. And they are quickly being embraced by those who are involved in the teachings of transpersonal psychology, which is the psychology of the spirit. And so I think it's important for us to understand those principles and to see how they are contained with what it is that we believe and what we practice in religious science. And what I know about principles of universal truth is that they are timeless in nature. And they are as applicable today as in the time that they were originally given. But we must also understand that they are always given in the context of the time. So consequently, what we have to do is we have to take those truths in their original form and continue to reinterpret them so that they are applicable to our modern lives. And so the principle here is contained in the Science of Mind textbook when Ernest Holmes said that principle is not bound by precedent, that the truth of our lives is not limited by our past experiences. And so consequently, they can always be, the truth is always coming forth, proceeding out of our past experience into something new and great and wonderful in our lives today. And so it is with the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. And what I would like to do is to just to reiterate what those four truths are, because I'm sure that many of you may not be familiar with them, and they're really very simple. And they've been interpreted in many different ways, and this is a way that you will often hear them interpreted. Number one, that life is suffering. Two, that the cause of suffering is selfish desire. Three, there is a way to end the suffering. And number four, the way to end suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path of right action, which includes right understanding, right judgment, right speech, right conduct, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And so what I would like to do with you here today is to explore, explain, and to expand those four truths into what I affectionately refer to as the five noble truths of religious science. So let us simply begin at the beginning, and the first noble truth of religious science is that there is suffering. We do not deny that there is suffering that we experience in our lives. And going back to the original teaching of Buddha, in terms of what he said, that life is suffering, well, we know that that is not absolutely true, because if life were suffering, then to end suffering, we would have to end life. And what Buddha was speaking to is the fact that when we don't have what we want, we suffer. And then when we finally get what we want, once the thrill wears off, we start worrying about losing it. And we're suffering again. So it seems like we're always caught up in this eternal cycle of either not having what we want or worrying about losing what we already have. But what is important here is to realize that there is the experience of suffering in our lives, and that suffering occurs in our mind and not in our body. In our body, we feel pain, but suffering takes place in our mental, emotional being. Because it doesn't feel very good to be angry. It doesn't feel very good to be sad, to be upset, to be frightened. That this is what suffering really is. And I know that growing up I used to hear this term about human suffering. I always thought of it in the context of these great catastrophes that human beings, you know, are susceptible to. And I never really related it to what was taking place in my life every single day, all of the little upsets, the uncertainties, the little worries that we all have. That is all a very, very subtle form of suffering. And what happens to us as human beings is when we don't feel good, we start looking for things to do to make us feel better. And so we start doing things, and we start doing lots of things, and we start doing them a lot. We start eating and drinking and smoking and sexing and shopping and gambling and running up big bills on our master charge. And we do these things not so much to feel good, but to keep from feeling bad. Now, back in the olden days, all of these behaviors, we used to call them sins. And now they've been elevated to the grand stature of codependent behavior. But what we really need to understand here is that healing begins when we become aware of our suffering. The moment we acknowledge that we are suffering, we enter into that state of consciousness where healing can now begin. And probably one of the best examples of that is the modern 12-step programs that have proliferated in our culture today. The very first step in those programs is to acknowledge that our lives are unmanageable and that we are suffering. And the very first thing they teach in those programs is that you must get out of denial. And I think probably one of the greatest examples of the importance of acknowledging our suffering comes from the greatest miracle of Jesus, which is when he resurrected Lazarus from the tomb. And if you go back into the scriptures, it is recorded that he was troubled and he groaned within, and then he wept. And after he wept, then he prayed. Because what he did is he began by acknowledging that there was suffering within him, and he allowed for that emotional release. And I think this is so important because as a practitioner, so often I have people who come to me, especially people who are new to this teaching, and they feel like if they're not deliriously happy in every moment, somehow they are doing religious science wrong. And I give them permission to cry. In fact, I always feel that I've earned my fee as a practitioner if I can make my clients cry. Because I know that when wisdom warms the soul, that tears stream forth. That's our soul's communication, that healing has begun. And so it's not a matter of crying or whining about the conditions of our life. It's not about being a victim. It's about understanding that what always manifests is our intention. And when our intention is to be healed, that the first step is to acknowledge the suffering and allow for that release, to allow the suffering to be released, and then to turn to God, just like the example of Jesus. Because, you see, religious science is a healing philosophy. And a healing philosophy is a dealing philosophy. It means that we deal with the conditions that exist in our life right now. And a dealing philosophy is a revealing philosophy. And what we reveal is the truth about ourselves. We reveal the divinity within us. We reveal the hero within us that Melissa sang about this morning. That's something greater that is already within us, that its expression is being blocked by our suffering. And we release that suffering so that that greatness within us can find its expression. So the first noble truth of religious science is simply to acknowledge that there is suffering in our lives. And the second noble truth is to understand that the cause of suffering is false belief. Now, in Buddha's time, he said that the cause of suffering was selfish desire. But what is the cause of selfish desire? I would suggest that this was revealed through the teachings of Christ, when so often he said that as you believe, so you shall receive. You see, we suffer when we believe what isn't true. It is that simple. And what we need to understand is that our suffering always precedes our pain. If we believe that our life, or that life itself, will not support us, we begin to worry about money and other things that we need for to live our lives. And that worry is a form of suffering. And what happens is that the more that we worry, eventually those fears come upon us. And we begin to experience the pain of poverty, the physical reality of it. And all that does is that it just expands or it magnifies the fear that was already within us that we were experiencing as worry. Because that worry at its heart there is fear and doubt. And that is the cause of the suffering, this belief that there is not enough. Conversely, if what we truly believe, that life is abundant, will always support us, that will become our experience of life. And so this is just one example in terms of talking about this in relation to money. It's something most of us can probably relate to. But each of us is filled with many, many different false beliefs that give rise to the suffering that we experience in our lives. And to try to root out all of those false beliefs really could be a never-ending task. And one of the easy ways to go about this is to realize that there is a master belief that we all hold that is false. And that is the belief that we are separate from life. You see, all emotional reactivity that we experience always comes from this false sense of separation, including selfish desire. Suffering arises when we believe in duality. And Ernest Holmes speaks to this over and over and over again throughout his teaching, that all of our suffering arises out of our belief in duality, or the two-ness of life. Because the truth is the unity of all life, or the oneness of life. There's an old saying that two is not true, for God is the one that proceeds from none. That out of the nothingness comes the everythingness of life, the unity and the oneness of all life. You see, we can only fear or desire something that we perceive to be separate from ourselves. Because if you are one with life, what is there to fear? For life would never be against itself. It would never harm itself. If you are truly one with life, what is there to desire? For life would never withhold anything from itself. So the second noble truth of religious science is this idea that the cause of suffering is false belief, and the primary belief is in the duality of life as opposed to the unity of all life. Now, the third noble truth of religious science, quite simply, is that there is a way to end the suffering. That is the good news, the gospel of religious science. Because if something is so, there is a reason why it is so. And if you remove the reason, you remove what is so. To remove the cause of something is to remove the effect. And this is simply known as the law of cause and effect, which in religious science we simply refer to as the law of mind action. And it is in religious science that we learn this truth, and we learn how to use this law, and that we learn to transcend what we could call the secondary causes in our life, which are false beliefs, and go back to the primary cause of all life, which is spirit. And the nature of spirit is always good. So when we rest or abide in that causation, that spirit that is always good, the good to which there is no opposite, then we indeed ourselves become centers of divine causation. that the divinity within us finds its expression through us as we release all of the false beliefs that we hold about life. So the third noble truth of religious science is that there is a way to end the suffering, which leads us to the fourth noble truth of religious science, is that the way to end suffering is by right thinking. When we remove the false beliefs from our consciousness and we begin to think in alignment with truth, when we begin to think in alignment with the Word of God, then our lives are changed, they are transformed, and we are lifted out of the conditions in which we once lived. One of the mentors of religious science and one of Ernest Holmes' teachers, Mrs. Emma Curtis Hopkins, once said, "Our lives are held together by the glue that is our former way of thinking." And when we change that thinking, everything else around us begins to change. In fact, this very principle is sort of what we might even call the motto or the creed of religious science, that when you change your thinking, you change your life. Because right thinking will always produce right action in your life. When you are thinking correctly, you will be intuitively guided into divine right action. You will be in the right place at the right time, saying exactly the right thing to produce success and abundance in your life. Now, the difficulty comes here is that we, as human beings, already think that our thinking is right. It's the other person's thinking that's wrong. And that's where we get stuck. Because all conflicts arise out of I'm right and you're wrong. But there's a principle here that has really been one of the guiding principles of my life, is a statement that there can be no conflict when truth is in expression. Because truth is the unity of all life. And so, anytime that you are suffering, that is an indication. That is life's way of telling you, hey, you're believing something that isn't true. No matter how right you may think you are and how wrong you may think the other person is, if you are suffering, there is a greater truth to be known. Always. So in this way that we can use our suffering as sort of a tattletale of our subconscious mind to let us know when we're believing something that isn't true, when we are not thinking in alignment with truth. And this can be a very challenging thing to know, well, what is the truth that I should be thinking? And it seems like it requires a constant vigilance on our consciousness, but there is an easier way. And that is what takes us to the fifth noble truth of religious science. Buddha brought us the first four noble truths, and Christ brought us the fifth, that the way to right thinking is love. The way to right thinking is love. And when I speak of love, I speak of something more than just a simple feeling or nice sentiment that we may have. For love is a force, it is a power that expresses the unity of all life. That love is the principle of the unity of all life that is felt when it is expressed. When we are in the expression of the unity of life, we feel it as what we call love. It feels like bliss. It feels like freedom. It feels like joy. It feels like peace. That each of us have our own unique experience of it, but we know it when we feel it. What happens to you when you are doing something that you love to do? Just ponder that for a moment. What does it feel like when you are doing something that you absolutely love to do? Have you noticed how you forget about yourself as something separate, doing the doing, you might say? That when you are doing what you love, you forget about the separateness of yourself and you literally become the doing of it. You become one with it. Time collapses. Do you ever notice how time flies when you're having fun? That we enter into that spiritual state of love in which there is no time. You see, Because love is that awareness of oneness. When we are in the state of love, in the expression of love, we come into an awareness of oneness. And it's also true when we are with someone we love. It seems like the time goes by so quickly. And we simply do not feel separate from that other person. They feel almost like they are a part of who we are, because they are, in truth. And so the way to right thinking, you see, is love. Because all logic, which is the process of thinking, all logic begins with a premise. We start with a premise. And if you have a false premise, you will come to a false conclusion. And so if your thinking begins with the appearances of your life, all you will ever produce is the logic of your suffering. If you have a problem in your life and you begin the process of thinking with what's in front of you, what you see, then all you will produce is the logic of how you have produced suffering in your life. You end up in this sort of endless loop. And there is only one way to break that cycle. And that is to begin your thinking with the premise of love, or the principle of the unity of all life. And so when somebody comes and steps on the tail of my belief system, and I find myself beginning to suffer, to be an upset, worry, whatever, what I always do is I employ a form of spiritual logic that in religious science we call spiritual mind treatment, because that's what it is. It is a form of spiritual logic that produces clarity in our thinking and brings truth into our being. And so consequently, when I am upset with someone, rather than blaming them and figuring out all of the reasons why they're wrong, I have to pull myself out of the situation where I can get and be still and to go within and to simply say to myself, there is only one life. And that each and every individual that I experience in my life is an expression of that same life that God is and I am. And because I know that life cannot be against itself, I therefore know that I cannot be against my neighbor, nor can my neighbor be against me. That together in the wholeness of the one life that is God, that we can only be for a fuller and greater expression of our own true nature, which is love. And out of the self-giving nature of that love, I know that there can only be harmonious interaction, perfect agreement, and freedom for all. Amen. That is spiritual logic. That is spiritual mind treatment. And I know from having done this so many times that no matter how upset I am, when I go back and I say those words to myself and I work that through, there is always a release. There is always freedom that comes. And I go, yes, it isn't about the other person. It is about myself. It is about the way that I am thinking, because I was not thinking from love. I was thinking from duality and separation and blame. So that is why this principle of love is so important. And when we begin this idea with love and the unity of all life, it always lifts us up into the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path of Buddha, which is to have a right view. And the right view always comes from seeing from a higher state of consciousness. I mean, every survival manual that you will ever read that tells you when you get lost in the forest, the first thing to do is to climb a tree or go to a mountain to get a higher view, to be able to see further, to see in greater wholeness. And we must do the same thing spiritually, moment by moment, day by day, is to rise up. So if you want to change your altitude, you have to change your attitude. And if your attitude is duality and blame, you will never resolve the conflict. As Einstein said, we can never resolve a problem at the level of consciousness from which it was created. So the fifth and most important noble truth of religious science is that the way to right thinking is love. And recently there was a biography of Ernest Holmes that was published called Open at the Top, and the author of that book is a member of our church. Neil Volley. And so I had in a private conversation with Neil, he told me in doing the research for this book, the one thing that he was able to find that Ernest Holmes had confided in a number of people that were close to him is that if he ever had to do it over, he would have placed more emphasis on love. Because so much of our teaching is emphasized on the law, which is important. But it is love. And I think one of the reasons for that is that Ernest Holmes was just naturally such a loving person that he just took it for granted that everyone knew how to love. But it's a lesson that we all need to learn. So, let's put all of this together. I mean, the theory of this sounds wonderful and great and very logical and everything, but let's put it together in a real-life situation so this can become a practical part of our life and see how it really works. And so, here's a little example that I know every person here in one form or another has had, that this has happened to everyone. That you've been at a stoplight or a stop sign, or you were at a driveway ready to pull out into traffic, and suddenly from behind you, you hear the horn honking. And just about the time you're ready to do something rude, you look in the mirror and you see that it's a friend of yours and they were just honking to get your attention and say, "Hi." And what happens? Immediately you turn your frown upside down and you're waving and smiling, right? So little episodes like that happen to us all the time. But they happen so quickly we never think about, well, what are the spiritual principles involved in this? But let's kind of run it through slow motion. The first thing that happens, you're sitting there, you hear the horn, you are startled. There is fear, and then you react to the fear by getting angry. You are suffering. You're sitting there suffering because you have heard this horn. That's the first step, number one. Number two, the false belief. Part of that suffering is based on a false belief that the guy behind me is a jerk. Step number three, this is when the law begins to go to work, that you look in the mirror. You begin to end the suffering by looking in the mirror and seeing a greater truth. Because up till then, everything has been based upon that horn. And number four, as a result of looking in that mirror, you have a new thought. And the new thought is, I like the guy behind me. And number five, the impetus of that new thought was love. You saw someone you loved, and you were lifted up, and it transformed your experience. And it didn't take 10 years of therapy for that to happen. It happened in an instant when your belief, your thoughts, your thinking was transformed by the principle of love. So what I want to leave you with here today is a little technique that you can use to go out and start working on this in your life. And it is, you know, a spiritual discipline that we're always up against and that we're always having to learn. And this is what I call the I love you and I accept you technique. And so what I would suggest that you might do for a single day, or maybe for a week, or hopefully for the rest of your life, is to simply notice every single person who captures your attention throughout the day. And by captures your attention, that means you notice that person and you start thinking something about them. And every time someone captures your attention, to silently say, I love you and I accept you. First, notice how you're feeling about the person, and then silently say, I love you and I accept you. Now, when you see someone you like or someone who's very attractive, that's very easy to say. But when you see someone that you don't like so much or who is upsetting you in some fashion, as you go to say, I love you and I accept you, there will be this huge resistance inside of you. And where you're going to feel it is right down here. And it's what I call the knot of separation. Emma Curtis Hopkins called it the silent protest. But you will feel it, and you will feel this resistance. And this little voice inside of you will be saying, but I don't want to love that person. They took my parking place. They cut in front of me in line. They look like my brother-in-law, and I don't like him either. But this is the work that we have to do. We break through that resistance, and one of the ways that you do it is by first taking your attention off of the person and watch the feeling. Look at the feeling and breathe into it. Because what you'll notice, when that knot of separation arises, you stop breathing. You tighten up. You start breathing. Instead of start breathing and watch it and feel it and just start saying, I love you and I accept you. I love you and I accept you. And I love to give this talk. You know, every once in a while I get invited to speak because it always reminds me to go back and do this again myself. And what I remember the first time I ever did this, I was so surprised at how critical I was about everyone around me. And then a year later when I did it again, I was somewhat pleased that it wasn't nearly as bad as it was the first time, but it still wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. And every time I do this periodically and go back and redo it, I can sort of see where my progress has been. But it is the willingness to love. You see, oftentimes we don't know how to love our neighbors. And what I do in my prayers, very often when I'm really confronted with a difficulty and I'm really upset with someone, I will just sit there and I'll close my eyes and I'll put my hand, one hand on my heart, and my other hand out in front. I will imagine that person in front of me and I will just say, oh Lord, I may not know how to love this person, but I am willing for you to love them through me. Because that is the most important thing, is your willingness to change, your willingness to love. And when you do that, Spirit responds. And it finds a way to start changing you, to open you up to love. So, in final review, the five noble truths of religious science. Number one, there is suffering. Number two, that the cause of suffering is false belief. Number three, there is a way to end the suffering. Number four, the way to end the suffering is by right thinking. And number five, the way to right thinking is love. Now, if you can't remember all of that, there's even an easier way. And that is, the next time you're upset with somebody, is just sit down, take off your shoe and your sock, and grab your big toe, and say, this little piggy is a suffering. This little piggy believes in lies. This little piggy knows how to end it. This little piggy tells the truth. And this little piggy says, I love you, I love you, I love you, all the way home. Thank you.